This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
It's important for us to understand the ins and outs of travel, I think, because we want to find out whether or not it's something that actually makes us happy or not. Does it benefit us? Also, it's important to find out whether or not by traveling, we're having a negative or positive influence on the environments that we do visit. And it also, thirdly, I think it raises questions about the relationships between those of us who are privileged enough to travel by choice and the people whose lands we are actually visiting. I mean, what kind of relationship is there between hosts and travelers?
That was today's guest, Dr. Andrew Stevenson, who is the author of the book, The Psychology of Travel. And you just heard a few of the big questions we'll explore today. Dr. Stevenson is a senior lecturer in psychology at Manchester Metropolitan University. And as a cultural psychologist, he is in the unique position to help us unravel some of the mysteries of travel from an academic and a psychological perspective. Some of the things we get into today, we get his advice on managing travel fears and anxieties, how to use travel as a tool for self-development. We explore some of the dilemmas of cultural integration. You know, how much should we maintain our own cultural heritage when we're traveling or living abroad versus integrating into a new culture? Why is travel so memorable? How does travel change our perception of time? We get some perspectives on travel in the age of eco-anxiety. That's a term I never heard until I read this book. And we talk about some of the psychological factors behind different kinds of travel and so much more. Tons to unpack today, and it's happening in this episode right now. So buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here, and welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey there, it's Jason with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show, my friend. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms, to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. I was really excited for this one. Dr. Andrew Stevenson is here. Again, the book, The Psychology of Travel, and it was a fascinating read, especially for me, given that I've been having conversations with travelers for over a decade here on the podcast, and much longer than that, just out in the world traveling. And I thought, wow, what a unique opportunity to bring somebody who has applied their expertise, their academic background to travel. And one of the big questions here, why do we travel? And does travel make us happier? Just a couple of the many big topics we're working to unpack today. Hope you enjoy this conversation. Stick around on the back end if you'd like. I want to give a shout out to a listener in this community who had a memorable trip recently. You'll hear why. And want to leave you with a quote to wrap things up. So stick around for that. In the meantime, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Andrew Stevenson. And I will see you on the other side, my friend. Yeah, whereabouts are you?
I'm in Manchester, where I live and work. But recently, just returned from Finland, actually.
What were you doing over there?
Well, it was our honeymoon, funnily enough. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we went to Helsinki and a place called Matildadal, which is a national park, to do lots of open water swimming.
Nice. The happiest country in the world. A couple of years running now. Yeah, were you looking at that from an anthropological perspective as you were on your honeymoon?
It was very welcome because there was a good atmosphere, and it's not very densely populated. I think that may have something to do with the happiness level.
Yeah. Where did you meet your partner?
Well, we've been together 27 years, and we used to play squash together. So we're both really lived here in Manchester for two or three decades.
Okay.
I don't know if you've been here.
Not to Manchester, no.
No, it's gets a reputation as being a rainy city. It's not as rainy as they say.
Well, that's great. They sealed the deal after a couple decades, huh?
Yeah. Well, a colleague of mine at the university where I work in the psychology department is a follower of your podcast, and she put me onto the podcast and listened to a few episodes. I like the one with the man at seat 61.
Thank you.
It was great. I've been following him for a long time as a keen cyclist and traveler on, trying to avoid driving, you know, and flying. So, so thanks to Leanne for, you know, alerting me to your great podcast.
Well, thank you. And thank you for taking the time to be on it as a guest here. I should formally welcome you, Andrew Stevenson, author of The Psychology of Travel. Welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend. And yeah, this is a fascinating book for me, you know, having talked to travelers for over, I know, what, 10 years now on this podcast, and having been nomadic myself for a decade, and kind of looking at what you've created here with the book and digging into the psychology behind some of the things that we may experience or feel as travelers, and getting that, I don't want to say academic perspective, because the book's great. I mean, it's very well explained, each principle, but you have psychological principles kind of backing up a lot of these big questions, which we're going to basically kind of go through today. And before we do, I wanted to ask you a bit about your specialty, because on the back of the book, it says you're a cultural psychologist with a particular interest in social and visual anthropology and cultural geography, which you've explored through ethnographic documentary films and soundscapes. So can you translate all of that for us, please?
I'll try. Well, you mentioned nomadism just now, and I'm a bit of a academic nomad, I suppose, because really I am trained in anthropology, and psychology is also the subject which I did my first degree in. So I'm probably situated somewhere between the two. I like to try and explore the idea of place and travel, and how, and the effect that it has on people, and how people get attached to certain places. You can't escape being in a place. We're always somewhere, and that always has an effect on us, you know, and travel is integral to that. And funnily enough, psychology doesn't always have a lot to say about places, because it focuses a lot more on people, and sometimes it talks about people as if they are separated from where they are. And all of our listeners will know that, you know, the mood that they have at the moment may largely be down to how dark it is outside, or how crowded their surroundings are, and all those sort of emplaced aspects of the environment that has an effect on us. So I'm pretty interested in that. And the other thing that you mentioned there is the idea of culture, and culture and place are related. And I'm also interested in the way in which people from different cultures develop different lifestyles and habits and so on. And in the case of travel, funnily enough, we should remember that travel is often something which is quite exclusive to certain cultures. And there are lots of people in many cultures who don't have the opportunity to do tourism. So it's easy to forget that sometimes.
Absolutely. I'm really glad that you brought that up right here at the top. I think it's important to acknowledge that. Yes, psychogeography, is that a bit of what you're describing? And I know in the book you said, quote, it's just as people affect places, places affect us as we move through them. And it's that sort of dynamic.
Yeah. Psychogeography is a word which is made up of two words that have been sellotaped together, really. It's got a couple of different meanings, but really it's about how we understand and change the places around us as we live in them. Sometimes we think that places affect us, but of course we've got to remember that we also leave our footprints, and we leave our environmental footprints all over the world, and we have to think about it the relationship between people and places as being reciprocal, you know, and that's, I suppose, that in one way is what psychogeography is about. What's the link between how we live and the environment around us?
Why is that disconnect there so often for human beings in terms of consideration of the place we're in impacting us, as you mentioned, kind of writing that off and being in our own bubble in some ways as humans, which is can happen quite often. I feel like we can, you know, maybe it's just the modern day or whatever. We're not living off the land or however you want to describe it. But for some reason, I feel like we are not always aware of the fact that we are truly connected to everything and it's affecting mm-hmm. us at the same time. Why is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, this whole idea of connectedness is very important. But when we think about raising our consciousness about the effect we have on our environment, bubbles is a very topical word, isn't it? Because we were sort of invited to live in bubbles when we were in the pandemic recently, and we were seen as a good thing, you know, to be able to, in a way, separate ourselves from our neighbors and those people around us. But outside of the pandemic scenario, we often travel in various types of bubbles, don't we? Like our vehicles, we can see the world as it flies past our windscreens, but we don't often always fully immerse ourselves with the senses in all the places that we go through. And so it's quite, I think that's one of the reasons why we sometimes feel a bit disconnected. And also, if you think about I'm just thinking about the concept of like the package holiday, for example, which is one way of traveling. That's kind of a bubble in itself. Because we sometimes pay companies to shield us from aspects of the cultures that we visit that we don't want to immerse ourselves in. So that, sometimes that's a privilege, but also just reduce the amount of connectedness. But there are lots of different ways of traveling, and not all of them are so separated as that one. Just one example.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this is something I was talking about yesterday during a conversation, because I talked to somebody who had done these really epic trips, you know, tens of thousands of miles. They did one on 25,000 K on a bike, and then over 3 years, and then 10,000 on a sailboat, and then they did a huge motorcycle journey from Spain to Cape Town, and all of these modes of transportation change the bubble, or maybe break the bubble. In some ways, if you think about biking, you know, you're really engaged. I mean, you can only go through a village so quickly on a bike.
I mean, that is such a good point. And bikes are a great example of this. I mean, I've always been a keen cyclist. And one of my favorite trips, this is way before I started studying the psychology of travel, really. But one of my favorite trips was a bike ride across Malaysia. And when I started in Kuala Lumpur and went up to Georgetown, it took me about 5 weeks. But the thing that this was in 1999, I think, and what kept coming back to me throughout that journey was the fact that I was obliged to engage with not only the destinations, the famous bits of Malaysia, if you like, to the outsider, but I also had to engage with every stretch of road in between. And it kind of meant that I was much more engaged, I think, in the totality of the journey as much as the destinations. And, you know, that's one way of traveling, and I was comfortable with that. But I guess it also is a bit of you expend a lot of energy doing that kind of traveling. And for some people, they prefer instead to, for example, visit Britain and go to Edinburgh, London, and then go home. It depends what kind of travel you want to be, whether you want to be a kind of explorer, I suppose, where you're looking at all the bits in between, places between places, as someone once said, or whether you want to focus on the destinations that are most publicized, you know. So it's different methods of travel, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I mean, bring up a good question that perhaps people can consider on a future trip. You know, you mentioned the totality of the journey versus destination specific. I think that's a really healthy way to look at a trip. You know, even if you are going to specific destinations, as we do, we plan an itinerary, we have certain logistics we have to plan, and everybody has their comfort level with, well, that's something they talk about in the book that we'll get into later, you know, the idea of like, you know, having things planned out versus spontaneity and things like that. But these are good things to consider when you're trip planning. And I think that's part of the goal of the podcast here is to kind of demystify the idea that you can't do a certain mode of traveling. I've talked to a lot of people bike touring, for example, that, you know, they had never pedaled a, you know, more than 5 miles in their life or whatever before they went on some big bike trip. And like, these are things that are accessible. You just have to choose them.
Yeah. And you're inevitably going to find yourself in places where tourists are quite rare, you know. And so the response and the relationship that you will have with the hosts in those particular locations is going to be slightly different than if you were visiting a place where tourism was commonplace. And so I'm thinking about, you know, on my bike in Malaysia, I just remember going through sort of smaller villages where if you stop, get off your bike, people will come to you and talk to you and maybe ask you questions and, you know, look at your bike, those types of things. But of course, if you were to cycle, for example, through London on your bicycle, which actually isn't as dangerous as it sounds because they've got quite good cycle lanes in London, but you certainly won't attract any attention or curiosity. Do you know what I mean? So it's that different kind of response and relationship that you get, which is in some ways a function of how common tourism is in that place. When I was in, going back to this bike tour, I wasn't planning to talk about this, but it seems to be quite a good example. I mean, I remember also meeting quite a few people who were doing backpacking on that same route, but I was also cycling in between those routes, and their experience was quite different, I think, because they tended to hop between certain destinations that had been identified in the Lonely Planet guide in the days when we used to use paper guidebooks. You know, the recommended ports of call along the journey were identified, and I think there was that kind of hopping between identified places. And I wasn't really able to do that because I couldn't avoid it. I know there's other people who are doing, you know, long distance walks. Listeners who have done long distance walks or long cycle trips will identify with this idea that you've got to be ready to visit everywhere, you know, along the way.
Yeah, ready to visit everywhere. I love that. It's a call to arms, right? You're ready to visit everywhere. Yeah. I mean,
that's it.
You just described another bubble, the backpacking bubble, you could call it, right? But I mean, I think, like, you know, I've done that. I've been that backpacker, and I think that, you know, you have choices along the way. It's not black and white, right? Like, you can be aware of the bubble you're in and still make a conscious effort to get outside of it. You know, I mean, this is the same with, there's the expat bubble, people call it, right? You can go to a place where a lot of expats live and you can hang out with only expats and, you know, be a part of that scene and not take the time to foster those deeper connections with locals that live in the community. Or you can be in that same place and make the effort. You know, it's, of course, these bubbles are easy to be a part of if you're familiar with that culture and you're ingrained in that, let's call it guidebook culture in that time, right? I mean, if you want to call it that.
Yes, you're right. Yes. I mean, I've got a nice quote here I was going to read. One of the distinctions that people often make is, and I think this is what you've been referring to here, is the difference between a traveler and a tourist. And they often say that travelers are what we call ourselves and tourists are what other people call us, you know. And so, because a lot of us like to think of ourselves as travelers. But there's a nice quote from a nice quote from Paul Bowles, who wrote his novel The Sheltering Sky, all about a journey in North Africa by some American expats. And he said that the difference between a traveler and a tourist is that whereas the tourist generally hurries back home at the end of a few weeks or months, the traveler belongs no more to one place than to the next, moving slowly over periods of years from one part of the earth to another. And I think that's, you know, that's a nice way of putting it, really. It's a bit more of a commodity being a tourist, isn't it? Whereas the traveler is a bit more of an explorer, maybe.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit, and there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Now, back to the show. Well, we're going to get into some of the questions that you address in the book. I know, I mean, even on the back book, you say, you know, why do we travel? Are holidays good for our health? There are all these questions, and you have them supported by psychological principles, which is fascinating. Before we get into it, I had a couple more questions for you. First of all, I guess I would say, why is the having an understanding of the psychology of travel important? Like, what can it do for travelers?
That's a good question. I've said to a friend of mine who maybe read this book, but don't read it actually while you're on holiday, because you might start to analyze a little bit too much what you're actually doing while you're traveling. But I think it's important for lots of reasons, really, because travel's such a common part of many people's lives. And by the way, we should point out that travel doesn't just mean tourism. There are lots of people who travel for other reasons, whether it's to do with migration or study or work and so on. Okay, most of travel may be tourism, but there's lots of travel that isn't tourism. So it's important for us to understand the ins and outs of travel, I think, because we want to find out whether or not it's something that actually makes us happy or not. Does it benefit us? Also, it's important to find out whether or not by traveling, we're having a negative or positive influence on the environments that we do visit. And it also, thirdly, I think it raises questions about the relationships between those of us who are privileged enough to travel by choice and the people whose lands we are actually visiting. I mean, what kind of relationship is there between hosts and travelers? One nice piece of research suggested that people tend to get on a lot more positively with the hosts of the places they're visiting when they are of equal status, or they see themselves as equal status. And you just talked about bubbles, and when we manage to step out of those travel bubbles and maybe socialize with people on an equal footing, maybe visiting people's houses in the places we're visiting, that often can have a good effect on reducing prejudice and developing understanding between cultures. Conversely, when we visit a place and the only people from those cultures who we ever meet are the people who are cleaning our hotel rooms or serving us drinks, that doesn't really help us that much to understand those cultures or reduce prejudice. So travel does have an effect on how we view people from different cultures and how we are viewed by different cultural groups. So there's lots of reasons, really, Jason, why the psychology of travel is important. Although I'm not, as I say, I'm not suggesting that you analyze these things while you're actually on holiday.
Yeah, I just thought it was important to address, because as we go into this, it's nice to know what travelers have to gain from some of this knowledge personally. And you know, one other thing is just kind of trying to assess. Maybe this is a question that will help assess this. This will be clear in a moment, but I'm wondering, you mentioned the impact of a place on a person. And, you know, for some reason, I think all travelers have experienced that feeling where you get to a place that you've never been. And for some reason, you just feel good there. It feels it feels like it fits like a glove. You don't know why. Other places, maybe, you know, it takes a little time to get under the skin of it. Maybe you feel a bit more comfortable with it later. Other places, just like, you know, I don't need to go back there for whatever reason. And some places you just feel that fit right pretty quickly, I should say. Maybe not right away. I'm just wondering about that feeling. Is that rooted in psychology? Or, you know, the underlying thing I'm trying to get out here is Andrew, where you're at on the woo-woo scale.
Well, it's funny, really, because, you know, in the contemporary culture of how many stars did it get, you know, this kind of idea that when you go to visit a place, the TripAdvisor attitude of, I'm going to give it 5 stars, it's a great place, or I'm going to give it 1 star. There's this, there's often a quickness to judge a place, isn't there, and say, oh, yes, that's a good place, or that place isn't so good. And as you just said, it takes quite a long time for it to get under your skin, or for you to get under its skin, I suppose, and develop a feel for a place. And too often, I think, personally, that when you go to visit a place for a couple of hours, you've almost not got enough evidence to say what kind of place that is. And if you think about a phrase like, the people in Norway are really nice. I mean, that phrase doesn't really work at all, does it? Because there are lots of different types of people in Norway, as there are in every place. And it takes a long time to really get to the stage where you can actually make an evaluation of a place. And psychologists often talk about something called mindfulness. You know, it's a therapeutic technique often associated with breathing and yoga and that type of thing. But really, mindfulness in travel is about paying attention to your surroundings. So you might think, let's listen to what's going on here. Let's listen to people talk. Let's look at observe what's going on. Let's engage with it physically. Let's go for a walk, those types of things, but with suspending judgment. So in other words, don't give it 5 stars yet. Don't give it 4 stars yet. Wait till you've been there for a while and give yourself time to make a judgment. I think really that goes some way to help answering our question a little bit about understanding how we judge a place, you know, and how we assess a place, is maybe just try to be a bit more mindful, because you don't have to give it a mark yet, you know.
Or ever, maybe, but it's, you know, it seems like a natural thing to do is to fall into the comparison trap, right?
Yeah.
Start comparing it. Can you explain that from a psychology perspective? Or, you know, and how do we, is there a practical exercise we can do in our minds to help us through not doing that, so we're not doing the rankings?
I think often there's a genuine altruism here, where we often want to help people by recommending things to them. And so if someone says to you, I'm going to Norway for a few days, there's almost that, and it's out of kindness in some ways, or maybe a sense of belonging or wanting to feel useful. Go to this place, but maybe don't go to that place. And so there is this element of comparison or an urge to recommend or to give advice. And, you know, we've got to remember that different people like different things. And if someone tells me that a place, a particular town in Norway, isn't very nice, that means that I'm probably going to visit it with lower expectations, obviously.
Yeah. You've already been tainted.
Yeah, exactly. And so in a way, I maybe would advise people to describe some of the things in a place if they're recommending them, but without saying it's not very good. Don't give me your evaluation. Just give me a description of what it's like. And then I can perhaps think about whether I'll like it or not. So I would try to be more mindful. It's not easy to do, mind, but to try to be more mindful in that we can maybe just suspend judgment, but still describe something. Mm. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what made me think about when you asked the question.
There's a fine line between planning and researching and then also letting all of that research influence, I suppose, your expectations, your judgment, as we mentioned, perhaps being tainted because you read 3 blogs that said this place was not good and only one that said it was good. And listen, you can't totally set these things to the side. This is part of, you're going to come across information as you're traveling, as you're planning a trip, as you're traveling.
Yeah, of course you are.
You're going to have conversations. People are going to share. I mean, there's that innate feeling as a human. You get excited about something, let's say even just a movie or something, and you know somebody and you know them well, and you think they would really enjoy it. And then you want to share your love of that with them because you want them to have that experience that you have because you care about them and you think that they're going to resonate with it. And, oh, you got to see this, you know, you're going to love it.
Yes.
And it's just like, it feels good. And that's what humans do. We share. Right?
We do. I mean, travel is often an innately social activity. There's a chapter in the book called about the social psychology of travel, and that's maybe the one takeaway from researching that was that I realized it's almost impossible to travel alone. You may think you're traveling alone, but all around you, other people are demonstrating activities which you might conform to or not. So you walk past a restaurant, if it's empty, the mere absence of people is often going to deter you from going in there because you might think it's an unpopular place. Even footprints can lead you to follow a path, or people are influencing you when they're not even there sometimes. And so the crowds or the other travelers often affect our decisions. That's aside from the people we are actually traveling with sometimes. So, you know, but if you travel with your friends or partners, and obviously they're going to, wherever you go is a compromise, isn't it, between the things that you both want to do. Hopefully, you both want to do the same thing, but quite often your activities are a compromise. So, you know, travel is a very sociable activity. I mean, obviously, I exclude here anyone who's climbing a mountain for the first time alone, and, you know, but maybe they're doing that because no one else has done it, and that's a social activity in reverse, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah. Well, I like that what you said, too, about the just describing a place. You know, I think I always thought when I heard about a place from three different travelers, it's probably a place I should go. And when I think back to, you know, that yes, they could say they don't know me and you're just sharing information, but what would get you excited about a place is the description of it, right? And like, what, you know, is, oh, that sounds like something. Oh, there's a hiking trail right by there. Oh no, you can go to this place. And oh, that sounds like something I'd really enjoy. And you're just kind of assessing it for yourself. The book, well, let's talk about the social psychology of travel. And one of the things you address in the book is the managing the travel fear. And I think this was an important thing I wanted to get some advice on because, you know, for all travelers of all levels, I think that, I shouldn't say levels, we don't, you know what I mean? Experienced travelers versus maybe somebody on their first.
Varieties, isn't it? Yeah.
You can be afraid of a destination. You can be afraid of flying. You can be, you know, having certain fears that, oh, well, let's talk about bigger fears like, oh, I'm gonna leave my job and travel for a year. Am I ever gonna get my career back again? And I mean, that's in a way tied into the type of travel we talk about here. So, you know, fear, anxiety, phobias, worries, this is something that you address in the book. And I just wanted to get your take on some of this stuff.
We often say that we live in an age of anxiety and lots of people worry about lots of different things. Travel, like anything else, can produce fear. But psychologists have talked about differences between fear, phobia, and anxiety. Usually when we talk about travel fear, it's, as you've just said, it's directed at a particular thing. It's got a focus. So it might be a fear of travel. It might be claustrophobia or something like that, or a fear of open spaces. Those things are a little bit easier to identify and work around. So if you've got a fear of travel, if you've got a fear of flying, you can still travel and you can find other ways of traveling. The more problematic, arguably, is the anxiety, travel anxiety. And that's a little bit more difficult to explain because it often lacks a focal point. It may manifest itself in a fluttery feeling or a sort of physical feeling of fear when you a trip is within a few days or something like that. But it's very difficult to point a finger at what it is that's causing you the anxiety. And that's a little bit more difficult to manage. and a phobia, I think that's just a kind of a clinical category of a fear. Like fears, phobias have particular foci, if that's a word. So, for example, they might have a fear of horses or aeroplanes. So, yeah, there's lots of different types of negative feelings. But we should also remember, and it's also been pointed out by some researchers, that worry, the fourth of the words that you just mentioned there, it may sound bad to be worried about something, but it's actually really useful to be worried, because flying, for example, to the United States, lots of things can go wrong there. So it pays ahead of the trip to be a bit worried, because if you're a bit worried, you will take those precautions, which mean that you're not going to leave the house without your passport, or you're going to make sure that you've packed sufficient belongings, or that you've
travel insurance.
Yes, booked accommodation, those types of things. So although some of these things like anxiety and fear are problematic, worry is a jolly good idea in general, because it leads us to make slightly more positive plans, really.
Okay, yeah. So embrace the worry for worry-free travel. But the anxiety, absolutely. Any tips on managing that from...
I mean, this goes back to things like... I mean, this is a harder question to answer. So I mean, off the top of my head, travel anxiety can, I suppose, be managed by indulging in slightly more conservative travel habits. If you are anxious, then that might be one of the reasons, justifiably, that you elect to travel in a bit more of a bubble. So in other words, you might travel with someone who's feeling a bit more confident or has a bit more experience, or you might travel with an established group. If you're a cyclist, for example, you might go on an organized itinerary. So I think this is one of the really positive things about the travel industry. It can help us with this anxiety by taking some of the organizational load off us. And a solo trip into a forest or across Malaysia, for that matter, is probably not for the anxious, you know. Those are some of the practices that could probably help you. In fact, come to think of it, I think the travel industry is an excellent form of therapy for anxiety, really.
Well, we're going to talk about if travel makes us happier. That's kind of where I'm going next. But I want to stay on this for a minute, because I think, is it always bad to have anxiety? I mean, don't we want to put ourselves out of our comfort zones? Isn't that where growth happens? And, you know, I've been in many situations where I've been very anxious and worried and all that stuff. And I've put myself in those situations purposely because, hey, I know, you know, when you go on a trip like this or whatever, you know, things are going to happen. And now I'm in that situation where something's happening and this is very uncomfortable and I'm scared. And, you know, isn't that kind of the point in many ways too? Like, I think that's one of the draws of travel for a lot of people, at least a lot of the people in this listening audience, is that, hey, we're going to get out of our routines. We're going to get out of our everyday, you know, humdrum thing. And we're going to put ourselves in situations that may not be comfortable. And, you know, trying to avoid all anxiety is like the opposite of that.
Mm. Yes, I think you're right. I think there is definitely such a thing as, we've talked about positive worry already, but positive anxiety can be associated with the learning process, can't it? I mean, if you go to school and you're learning a new skill, there's always that period where you think, oh, I don't know if I can do this. Obviously you need to go through that as part of the learning process. And I think traveling is also a good analogy for that as well, because when you're traveling, inevitably you're going to find yourself in places that are unfamiliar, and unfamiliarity is one of the things that provokes anxiety. The question is, how do you respond to that? And those people who are sort of maybe thrill seekers or maybe travel for adventure, those are the people who may relish that type of anxiety, and they may travel for reasons which are known as eudaimonic travel, which is kind of means self-improvement, really. So in other words, you're going to travel not just for fun, but or relaxation, or familiarity, but because you want to test yourself a little bit and maybe learn something new. For example, you know, I was in, I do some research in Guatemala, and so quite often I visit a town called Antigua, who some of your very popular with travelers, especially from the United States.
Beautiful place.
It's a lovely town in a city. It's a city in Guatemala. And it's very popular, as you probably know, because it's a hub of Spanish-speaking schools. And lots of people from the States visit there to learn Spanish. And that's kind of an example, because Antigua seems to me to be full of people who are traveling, but also they're putting themselves outside their comfort zone because they are speaking quite slow Spanish with a heavy American accent. And that's the kind of, and I think, you know, I've heard people talk about, you know, the preponderance of this strangely accented Spanish that's going on in Antigua. But, you know, if you do that for a few weeks or for a few months, then it might feel uncomfortable, but then you'll start to feel a bit more fluent and confident. And that's quite a nice example. I mean, Antigua is a bit of a bubble, because there are lots of other people from the States trying to learn Spanish as well. But it's a bubble where lots of people are simultaneously feeling a bit uncomfortable, and then you can come out of it and you've learned something. So that's quite a good example of traveling for self-improvement. I guess it's not an extreme sport like, free, what's that, climbing without ropes called? It's not like that, but it's putting yourself in a testing situation, I think.
Yeah. Well, this is tying in with that question, how does travel make us happier? Does it? And you mentioned the eudaimonic. How do you pronounce that?
Eudaimonic
well-being.
Yeah. I know I usually try to avoid pronouncing it, actually. I usually say self-improvement. But anyway, yeah.
Okay, well, eudaimonic well-being versus hedonistic well-being. Hedonistic being fun, enjoyment, you know, indulging, let's say. And eudaimonic being purpose, fulfillment, and that sort of thing. And this sort of, these are the dual principles that you bring up to kind of support this idea that travel makes us happier. But I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper in this. Not that anybody listening needs another reason to travel, but, you know, if you can tell us from a psychological perspective why travel makes us happier, we're going to take it, Andrew. We're going to take it,
okay,
and run with it.
That's fine. That's fine. Well, obviously, there's lots of different ways to be to find happiness. And I'm slightly annoyed, Jason, that you can already pronounce that word better than I can after
give me 5 minutes. I'll forget. So.
But, I mean, hedonism and self-improvement, let's say, are two varieties of happiness. You know, hedonism is basically, you know, sun, sea, and fun, and, you know, taking whatever substances, you know, get you high for a limited period. So hedonism is one of the main motivations for travel. And lots of people travel for that reason. But the other type of motivation for travel, which has been identified, is this idea of self-improvement. And really, I think one thing we can learn about this, what I learned when I was writing about this, is that I realized that there aren't two different types of people. There aren't hedonists versus those people who are trying to improve themselves. Actually, we ourselves can hop or alternate between these frames of mind during the same holiday, maybe. So we all know what it's like to go out and go to a party, and you might feel very hedonistic for 3 or 4 hours. And then the morning after, you might go to a museum and learn about an artist, or, you know, try to learn a language, that type of thing. So it's not about different types of people, but it's maybe about different types of activities, and both of which can bring us an amount of pleasure and fulfillment. So that's one point. The other point that struck me about this when I was thinking about it and reading about it is that what we would really like from travel is not just for it to make us happy while we are traveling, but for that happiness to have a bit of a projection into the future. So we'd quite like to come home from our visit to whatever place it was and still have a residual happiness. And it seems to be, from a lot of research that I read about, is that although We can't say that self-improvement is better than hedonism. It does seem that those people who err on the side of self-improvement do tend to report longer-lasting feelings of elevated well-being after they return from their travels. So that's just a thought. And this sounds a bit pompous, really, doesn't it? It's not that I'm saying all you've got to do is visit museums, learn languages, and learn how to cook Mexican food while you're traveling. But those types of experiences are important for perhaps longer-lasting well-being. I mean, you can carry on your Mexican cooking when you get home, can't you? You can continue learning your language. So I think it's important, really, to maybe alternate between the two a little bit.
When you explore a new skill, like let's use the Mexican cooking example, you know, I mean, you can't help but you're exploring part of yourself too. I wouldn't say indulging, but you're embracing that curiosity and following through with it. And I feel like that's another important muscle to build in life, right? Like you get curious about something and instead of just remaining curious about it and wondering about it, diving in and getting your hands dirty and making the tortillas or whatever.
Well, it's funny you should say about that, Jace. Yeah, absolutely right. And tortillas are a really great example. This is something that I've thought about a lot when I traveled, and it's not so much something I've written so much about, but I think there is something to be written about this, is that when you visit a place, you really, if you go somewhere as a tourist or a traveler, you've kind of got a choice about what kind of activities you can do in, let's say, in Guatemala or Mexico. You can do things which are for the tourists. So you can visit a famous palace or go and see a famous volcano. But also you can indulge in what I'd like to call everyday activities of that culture. So learning how to make tortillas is a great example, because in England, where I'm from, we don't really know anything about tortillas. Our supermarkets,
no.
We have, not really. We know, we've got wheat tortillas in the supermarket. But of course, you go to Mexico or Guatemala, the tortillas are made of corn. And the process of making them is pretty interesting. And they have these fascinating tortillerias where they make tortillas. And you'll hear this sound as you walk past.
Wonderful
them.
Sound.
It's not applause. Yeah. It's the making of the tortillas. Now, what you just said there about getting your hands immersed in a culture is, I think part of this self-improvement and part of this embracing of local culture is taking part in everyday activities of that culture, learning how to make tortillas rather than maybe visiting a Mexican restaurant just to eat them, you know. So those kinds of activities can really lead to longer lasting feelings of connectedness with the places that you're visiting. I've got another example of this, actually, that I thought about when I went on holiday to Iceland a few years ago, to Reykjavik. And I don't know if you've been there, but one of the most popular tourist activities in Reykjavik is to go to the Blue Lagoon, which is a natural, it's a heated outdoor
hot
pool.
Springs.
Yeah, exactly. That's the word I'm looking for. Heated hot springs. It's really popular and it is very nice. But essentially it's something that is something for tourists, really, or visitors. But also in Iceland, in Reykjavik, simultaneously, there are some really good local swimming pools which the locals go to. Now, I'm a pretty keen swimmer, and I was very conscious of the difference between these two activities. Both involved immersing yourself in water, but in one of them, you were doing something very mundane. You were just going for the daily swim up and down the lanes. There hadn't been any publicity about it. It was quite hard to find out about, but the only people there were pretty much Icelandic people. I really enjoyed that a lot, and I felt a little bit more connected while I was doing it. Whereas I've got a kind of natural aversion to things that are just for tourists, and I felt a bit uncomfortable. And I couldn't really swim in the hot springs anyway, because that's really not what it's for.
Nobody's going to tolerate your lane swimming at the Blue Lagoon,
not.
Andrew.
Forget that. People are drinking beer in there and stuff. So, you know, it's just an example of you can be in the same place, but, you know, the audience for activities is very different for different different types of engagement into it, really. So, yeah.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected, and I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning, and you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled babbel.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, Jason here. Did you know we have a free weekly newsletter over at zerototravel.com/newsletter? I put my heart and soul into this newsletter and love keeping in touch with listeners off the podcast. That's where you can find out about all of the latest and greatest events, trips we're planning, and of course, you're going to get money-saving travel tips, destination advice, all kinds of stuff to provide value and help you add more travel into your life. So why not sign up? Again, totally free, no cost at all. zerototravel.com/newsletter. Excited to welcome you into that community. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show. On the subject of travel as self-improvement, before we get off this, I'm just going to use a specific example, and I'm just curious on your thoughts. Let's say the person that is taking a career break. I think this is a good example because there's a real intention behind it, right? And perhaps that person's in a place where they're like, you know, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. I might want to come back and do it. I might want to pivot to something else. I need some time to just kind of explore, and I'm going to save up some money. I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to travel for a year, and I'm going to explore the world and learn about myself. And I'm really going to lean into travel as a tool for self-improvement and kind of have that expectation that it's going to transform me in some way. And I guess that's the part I'm curious about, your thoughts on the expectation piece. And I think travel is a great way to do this because you're setting up a block of time and a container in which to explore yourself in this way and what you might want in the next phase of your life. And also you're giving yourself the physical distance to kind of break free of the cultural norms or the routines of every day. And that does something to your brain as well, which I know I'm sure that's going to come up here in this conversation. We have a lot to get to, man.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that instance, when your intention is to use travel as a transformative tool, is there, in your opinion, and psychologically speaking, I guess I should say, or academically speaking, is that a healthy way to approach it? Like if you were looking at the spectrum of, you know, full intention of self-improvement versus I'm just going to be open-minded and see what happens and kind of like let this develop. And yeah, I have this intention, but I'm not going to like try to put too much pressure on it. I'm just wondering like what, you know, everybody's brain works differently, of course, but like what's sort of the healthiest way to kind of approach that?
Yeah. Well, quite often that kind of break or moratorium, if you like, in your life, where you might decide you want to go somewhere for 6 months, people approach that in different ways. And I don't want to say that one way is better than another, but one way of doing it is to focus that moratorium, that break, on gaining a connectedness with a particular location. Now, you've got to remember here that I am, by training, an anthropologist. And what anthropologists tend to do, this is actually a bit different from psychologists, is that they tend to have what's called regional specialities. So in other words, they tend to latch on to one place and they get to know that a hell of a lot, right? So actually, anthropologists aren't that well traveled, but they tend to go to one place a lot and get to know it a hell of a lot. So I do have that kind of mentality. So for me, if I was looking for a break and a period of self-improvement, I would probably think about the best way to do it would be to really get to know a particular culture or go and live in a particular place for long enough so that you could almost be, not, I wouldn't say go native, but at least become really familiar with the language and norms and customs of that place, and maybe work there as well. Because there's, you do feel differently when you're working in a place than you do when you're visiting a place as a tourist. Because if you work in a place, you're almost forced to engage with the sort of the daily routines and the bureaucracy and the lifestyles of that and the norms of that particular culture. And I think that's a really good way of getting to know a place and yourself personally. Of course, the other way of doing it, I suppose, is to do one of these sort of whistle-stop world tours where you tend to find out a little bit about lots of different places. Personally, I, for environmental reasons as well as for reasons to do with immersion and engagement with a particular place, I would favour the previous one. You can find out an awful lot about yourself when you really start to learn about a particular culture. But that answer that I've just given has a big asterisk next to it, and it's basically that it's been given by an anthropologist, because that's kind of the way we think a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's great that you mentioned that up front. And I mean, I've had both of those experiences, and I've gotten a lot out of both of them. And perhaps, you know, that was different, you know, different seasons in life, right? There was no way I was not going to run from place to place and see as much as possible at one point. You know, that was just like the mode I was in. But maybe, you know, hearing you, it's if you had to recommend one or the other, maybe perhaps the happy medium is this concept of slow travel, where you're perhaps spending just more extended time in various destinations. You get to see some places, but also stay long enough where you get the feel. I mean, this kind of, I'm jumping ahead here in my notes, but this was a fascinating chapter for me as an expat living in Norway, and the chapter on dilemmas of assimilation, separation, integration, and marginalization, and this idea of push-pull. This was really interesting because I'm a Norwegian citizen now, and I'm just going to use my own personal example, but I think other people listening can relate to this idea where you're carrying around your culture, and you have it all in your head, but you're not in it anymore, right? But you are a byproduct. You're a product of your culture. These questions you brought up in this chapter, you know, how much do I want to maintain my own cultural heritage when I meet new people? There's this idea, right? Where you're, you know, you start to understand how the locals operate. Like here in Norway, everybody's much maybe more calmer, speaking in a different, much different way than, you know, on the East Coast and in the United States. And then the other question you brought up is, how important is it for me to integrate into another culture? And then there was the biculturalism idea, that where you have you're fluent in two cultures, which I think that was describing me a bit more, and the effects of that on an individual. So there's all these, I'm throwing a lot out of you because I don't know where you want to start, but I mean, this is a thing that travelers experience, right? Like you're in a new place. I mean, I think we all do in some way. You start to kind of, you become, all right, let's say for a conscious traveler, you're trying to be respectful of a culture. So you start to adapt some of those behaviors. You're not going to necessarily stand up and do the thing you would do in the middle of a bar in America in another place, because they don't do that and it would be obnoxious and rude or whatever. And, you know, so you start to adapt your behavior and you're basically integrating to that culture. And just all these questions around this push-pull and these dilemmas, I just would love your thoughts on this topic.
Well, I'm glad you've gone in this direction, because this is perhaps the chapter which is most about traveling rather than tourism. And this really addresses travel in the context of things like migration and working abroad. And one area that's quite close to my heart, because I did my PhD about it, is the experience of international students. They're quite an interesting group of people, because obviously they tend to spend a year or maybe 9 months in a different culture. We have quite a lot of international students here in Manchester, and I'm fascinated by their experiences. And they obviously have, they're central to this process you've just described. And psychologists have come up with, as ever, a few sort of technical terms, which I try to put in everyday English. So we talk about acculturation and biculturalism and cosmopolitanism. And so those are the three words I've talked a bit about in the book. But acculturation, really, it just means what happens to you when you move from one culture to another, either permanently or for a few months. This isn't relevant to tourism so much, because however much you immerse yourself in another place for a week or 2 weeks, I don't think acculturation is going to happen much. So if you're there for 9 months, acculturation is really about, as you say, how much do you embrace or resist a change in the norms, beliefs, and values and lifestyles of the place that you are visiting? Do you, for example, try to retain your own sort of cultural identity as much as you can? Now, one way to do that, I suppose, and I'm just, again, using the international student as an example, and we're coming back to bubbles again here, I'm afraid, Jason, so much about bubbles here, is one way to do it is to maybe live in a hall of residence with only with people from your own cultural group, attend a course which has lots of people from your own language-speaking group in it. In other words, sometimes universities make it, in my view, a little bit too easy for people to spend a lot of time within their own group, and it often doesn't give them the incentive to explore so much. So that's one way of doing it. And I guess perhaps the more common way of acculturating is the halfway house version, which is kind of integration, where obviously you retain your love of, I was going to say English food in my case, if I was an international student, but English food is not a great example of anything. But let's just say I still support my football team and watch the football games while I'm abroad. But I at the same time, I do try to learn the new language. I experiment with Mexican food in this particular example. So you're doing that, retaining your own identity, but exploring, experimenting with other norms and values. So that's the kind of most popular and research suggests the most healthy strategy in terms of having positive attitudes about the culture that you're in, if you see what I mean. So prejudice against different cultural groups tends to reduce if you at least partly integrate and experiment. You don't have to wholly do it, but if you partly do it. I think that's a good strategy for a long game, like being in a different country for 9 months or 12 months.
What do you think the benefits of that are long term for somebody that then comes home and lives in their home culture?
Immense, in my view, immense, because, you know, in the international student example, quite a few of our students, and I'm sure this is happens in different countries, do a study abroad year. So they do 3 years of study in Manchester, and then they may go to, Malaysia or Australia for a year. And what they've got is not only have they got a degree in whatever it is that they're studying, psychology in the case of our students, but they've got a pretty much lifelong knowledge of a different culture. Possibly they've learned rudimentarily a second language. They've got this connectedness with a different culture and an understanding of the way that people, the fact that people just live differently in different places. And that might sound basic, but I'm pretty sure that if you never are lucky enough to have the opportunity to travel at all, it's quite possible to live through your whole life without really experiencing cultural diversity apart from the people who you meet in your own community, you know, which is fine. But to see and breathe and feel the way the smells are different and the temperatures and the daily habits are so different. And I think it's difficult to quantify that, but it's something that's so valuable for people. And when for example, if you can have an everyday conversation in a bar about, you know, about the greenhouse effect or overcrowding, and you may have read about it, but unless you've really experienced it in a city where the situation is so much more acute than the one you live in. People often talk about the traffic in Manchester being bad, but every time I hear that phrase, I just think about the people who have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning in Guatemala City to set off in their cars to get to work for 8 or 9 o'clock, just because they know that journey is going to take 3 or 4 hours. And it's only a distance of about 20 miles, you know, just the traffic is just off the scale. And so I know that from experience, and I could have read it in the newspaper. But I think, you know, it's a long answer to your question, but I think those types of everyday experiences give you a knowledge of another culture, which is hard to quantify, you know. And that's partly what integration and cosmopolitanism is about, is understanding that other people experience the world differently, you know. Somebody can tell you that, but you can't really appreciate it unless you've seen it. You couldn't explain to someone how to drive, could you? You have to be in the car to do it.
Well, yeah, what you mentioned, I think, is there's something about experiencing that on a body, visceral level that's different than the sort of the concept of it. Of course, that goes with anything, right? When you experience it, you take it in and it becomes a part of you. And that was fascinating to me because I've had so many different moments over the years assimilating to, or integrating into the culture here in Norway. And, you know, sometimes feeling like, you know, especially having children and wanting to impart my favorite parts of both of those cultures into them. And wanting to sometimes feeling like, oh, I got to hold on to these parts of me that are American, and you know, I'm just going to be this way, and this is, people are going to have to deal with it. And then the other day being like, you know, well, this is okay, this is where I live, and this is a part of, you know, who I am. And then sometimes feeling, you know, annoyed with that, and sometimes feeling super cool with that. And it's just a constant. You had the term push pull, and that I really resonated with that in this chapter.
I'm glad you described that, because listen to it as you describe it, and as I've tried to describe it, it presents the dilemma as an everyday dilemma. And this book, I know it's a psychology book, I understand that, but I've tried to write it in a way where it's not academic as such. It's got academic examples in it, but I'm trying to sort of convey a little bit about the experience of travel. And listening to you talk really helps us to understand what the push-pull of acculturation is all about.
Time is another thing. You talk about time perception. I think we all know this. Travel can seem to mess with time perception in many ways. I mean, I remember being in flows where it was just like everything was so, felt so, I felt like I was just on this bliss ride. And time was just, I felt like I was just living so many lives in a short period of time. And it's time bending in some ways, but there are some psychological reasons behind this. So just the relationship between time perception and travel, I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah. I mean, well, earlier on I mentioned mindfulness and talking about trying to experience the world without judgment so much. And mindfulness has got a companion, and the companion of mindfulness is known as flow. And some other psychologists have talked about getting into a state of flow. And we often use the phrase, go with the flow. And I don't know if you've, I mean, you must have had this. There must be an activity that all our listeners do where they just, time just seems to fly and they lose all track of time.
This,
and it's a great
right
feeling.
Now.
Yes, this conversation. For me, I love cooking. And when I'm cooking, I don't really think about what time it is or what I've got to do in a couple of hours, those types of things.
Yeah,
and
me too.
All our listeners will have these things. Now, flow has been studied in relation to travel experience. And it's One of the ways in this goes back to about happiness and travel as well. And one of the ways we often achieve happiness in life, as in travel, is to get into a state of flow. And some great examples of research about people who go on trips where they go to Latin American dance classes or salsa dancing or do deep sea diving, those types of things. Now, for some people, those are those flow moments where they've almost conquered their anxiety and they're worrying about the future, and they detach themselves from worries about what they did earlier, what they've got to do next. And so that's where time tends to be distorted in a really good way. But other people have also sort of done a bit of research on this to suggest that some people, you may know in your own lives, examples of people like this, find it really difficult to get into those states. And then others find it really easy to get into those states. I'm a bit jealous of those people who can do this a lot. I can do it some of the time. But, you know, how many people out there have checked their emails while they're on holiday and they find it very difficult just to get into that flow state and detach themselves from their sort of everyday concerns about the past and the future? So, you know, we are in this almost this this, it's not really a battle, but it's a challenge, challenging ourselves to try to lose ourselves a little bit in the moment and get into these states of flow and maybe get a bit more eudynamic about things when we're traveling. So we do edit our time a little bit as well by using photographs on holiday. And I always love the concept of travel photography because it's such a unreliable body of evidence about what you did when you were on holiday. It's great because really what you do is you take photographs of all the good bits, don't you? But you don't take photographs of those moments where you're in a queue or you need to get a new passport or you've lost something and you're trying to
find
it.
Hold on, we're arguing, honey. Let me grab my camera really quick.
Yeah, must take a picture of this, put it up on Instagram. So one technique we use to, again, edit time a little bit and publicize our experiences in a very selective way is to use photography. And that's great, isn't it? So the way that we do that. So yeah, there are all these different techniques of distorting time and experience, and long may it continue, I think.
Why is travel so memorable?
Yeah, well, again, memory, and that relates again to this idea of commemorating our holidays, isn't it? And looking at the positive aspects through photography. But historically, psychologists have studied memory and travel by using concepts like nostalgia and homesickness. And weirdly, you know, 200 years ago, nostalgia was actually listed as a psychopathology, you know, or a neurosis, you know. Whereas now we talk about it as just a sort of feeling of sadness for times gone by or places gone by. But memory and travel are connected by these concepts of nostalgia and homesickness. The difference between the two, incidentally, is that nostalgia is quite sad, really, because it's a memory for something that you'll never get back. Whereas homesickness, it is a sadness, but you can rectify it by it because that place is still there. So, you know, travel is memorable, but we also have memories of the places we leave behind. And I found when I was doing my research with international students from different countries who came to Manchester, I did a study about the experience of arriving in a new place. And how people constructed a sort of positive view of this new city they were in. How do you learn a new city? You know, it's quite difficult, really, and it can be quite bewildering. But people often use memories of where they are from to help them cope with a new place. So I worked with a few people from different countries, one person from Indonesia. Now, Indonesia, I think Ryan's saying, I haven't been there, but it consists of about 7,000 islands, an archipelago in the there's a hell of a lot of water in Indonesia, in other words. And so when this student came to Manchester, she was feeling a bit homesick and missing the water, I suppose. And so to make herself feel better, she used her memory of running water, and she went to look for some spots around Manchester where there was lakes and water features, if you like. And she went and did some sound recordings of them. And those memories of home helped her feel a bit better about being in a new place. I loved that example because it meant that it showed me that we don't just use photography and the visual sense to document our travel, but she wanted to use sound. She wanted to make sound recordings. And, you know, some people maybe who have sight impairment, for example, might use different senses to engage with a place and remember where they're from. So it's quite interesting. Yeah, psychology is very focused on vision and observation, and we should pay a bit more attention to things like taste and smell and sound, I think.
What ends up in our heads in some ways is just an amalgamation of all of our senses come together, right? I mean, it has to be.
Yeah, it is. And but you raised this a bit earlier on when you said that, you know, quite often we travel in a bubble, and quite it may be that sometimes we visit places and we don't ever see, we only ever see them, you know, through glass maybe. And maybe what we need to do is get out and, you know, feel the temperature and jump in the water and smell the food a little bit more and make it a bit more of a sensorial experience. So it's important to do that, I think.
I like in this chapter, you had the Steinbeck quote, "You can't go home again because home has ceased to exist except in the mothballs of memory."
Well, I know, it's tragic, isn't it? So that's his Travels with Charlie, and it's a nice literary way of describing this feeling of nostalgia. But, you know, on the positive side, for certain people who have suffered memory loss and experience dementia, travel has actually been used as a way of improving memory. You know, like returning people to places that they grew up. We can use this idea of sort of environmental cues to bring back memories, almost literally. And so that's quite a good sort of example of therapeutic travel. It's almost the opposite of nostalgia, because you're actually revisiting a place you grew up in, and that can bring forth lots of interesting stories that you may have thought you'd forgotten. So it can be a good thing in that sense as well.
The last chapter in the book, I believe it is. Yeah, where do we go from here? Travel in the age of eco-anxiety. I think it would be a big mistake not to discuss this. And I just wondering if you could give us a little bit more information on eco-anxiety, how you define that, and just some thoughts, advice, perspectives around this topic.
Yeah, I mean, okay, eco-anxiety is a phrase that's quite new in psychology, but it's actually, I like to call it justifiable eco-anxiety. Many forms of anxiety are often diagnosed as being, you know, an illness, but actually it's a really good idea to be anxious about the future of the planet, because if we have a certain amount of anxiety about the future of the planet and the effect that travel is having on that, air travel and so forth, then in a way that's going to raise our consciousness a little bit and help us to modify the way that we experience the world through travel. And I think you recently did an interview with someone who visited all the countries in the world without flying. I think I had a look at that as a podcast. That kind of outlook is becoming, for me, refreshingly more common. Eco-anxiety is obviously, just to define it, it's a feeling of anxiety literally about our future and the future of the planet. And I think we do have to try to address this by developing ways of traveling which are less damaging. And that's an obvious thing to say. But we've talked a lot today about how you can engage with the world a lot more on the ground, almost literally on the ground, rather than just flying from one destination to another. And I think the positive experiences of travel really belong to every point along a destination. And I've got a friend who's just about to set off from England to Istanbul on his bicycle. And he's actually not a very experienced cyclist. And Ben, if you're listening, you know, good luck. But I think you're going to really experience every part of this journey in a much more engaged way than you would be if you were just flying over there. So I think we have to think a bit about traveling in a more responsible way. If you are going to fly across the planet, maybe at least stay in that destination for a while and, you know, make it a proper immersive experience rather than flying to lots of places just for two-day visits. You know, don't want to sound preachy about it, but you've got to think about this type of thing. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge in travel as it is in all sorts of interaction, you know. I was in just finally on that and the way that the world is changing a little bit in terms of travel and work and so forth. I was in Central America recently doing some work. I was there for a few weeks and I met quite a few people who were from the States, but they were what I call digital nomads, and they were still working their 9-to-5, but they were traveling at the same time. And so this seems to be a new and quite interesting development that seems to be happening a lot more now, where people are, instead of just traveling for vacationing, they're trying to mix travel, exploration, and work. And because we've got our laptops and we don't need our physical offices so much, I think this digital nomadism trend is a definite option for some people in certain professions, of course, not others. But the last chapter is all about the future of travel, and it takes in eco-anxiety and digital nomadism and those types of things, which at the moment we're not entirely sure about, but we're still learning about them, really, Jason.
Well, I had a good run as a digital nomad. It's a nice time, and we're very lucky at this day and age that we can take our work with us and see more of the world. But I think eco-anxiety is, to me, it's a good anxiety because it's an opportunity. It's an awareness around something that's real, and it's an opportunity to make certain choices to alleviate that anxiety a bit, knowing that you're doing what you can in your own way to kind of make the right choices.
Yeah.
I think that's the way I'm seeing it anyway right now in this moment. Fascinating book here, Psychology of Travel. Yeah. Anything else you want to share in terms of like where to find the book or your website or anything like that? Go for it.
Well, I just want to thank everyone for listening, and thanks Jason for such a sort of thought provoking interview. And the book will be easy to find. Although it is a very slim volume and it's perfectly portable. As I've said before, it might be a good thing to read, in your everyday life as much as while you're sitting on a beach. But I just hope, we've tried to explain some of the ideas. It's not particularly aimed at the academic community. It's aimed at anybody who likes to travel and to think about travel. So I think that's all I want to say there, Jason. But thanks ever so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation, and it's nice to know an expert on this topic. So don't be surprised if we have you back on, Andrew.
That would be a pleasure. Okay.
Thank you so very much, and enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks again for your time.
You too. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye. Bye.
There you have it. I want to thank Dr. Andrew Stevenson for stopping by the show. Again, the book, The Psychology of Travel, we'll link to it all in the show notes. Very cool to chat with him. And I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite quotes in just a moment, one of those play on words kind of quotes that I love. But first, I want to give a shout out to a listener in this community. I, not too far back, put out a challenge to travel with a loved one. And I got an email from Katrina, who said, "Hi, Jason, my name's Katrina, and I'm writing you from Charlotte, North Carolina. I've been listening to your podcast for years. Absolutely love it. And with every new episode, my travel bug grows and grows." Thank you, Katrina. She goes on to say, "My mother and I just got back from a trip to Paris. So your mention about traveling with a loved one really resonated with me, and not to wait to do it. As my mom is getting older, her health is becoming more varied. Nothing very serious, though. We had to take this trip at a much slower pace than I'm used to traveling. I learned that the more we travel together, the more of a caregiver role I step into, making sure she has my arm to hold on to when the walking or all those steps in and out of the metro becomes too much, finding a place for her to sit down when she starts to get dizzy. But even with all of that and other things, we had the best time together. Goes on to say, I just 100% agree that we should be traveling with our loved ones while we can. Time waits for no one, and we don't want to keep pushing off these special trips. And, you know, said some other kind things, but I just wanted to share a shout out to her for making those memories with her mom. And just another reminder, I think it's worth reminding all of us that travel is a great way to make memories with loved ones, as you know. And if you haven't done it in a while, something to think about. Okay. We'll leave you with a quote in just a second. A quick reminder, jason@zerototravel.com is my email. Would love to hear from you. I mean, I share these listener shout outs because I want to invite you to get in touch. If you haven't done so, just say hi. I have a voicemail box. You can easily leave a message on. I respond to all of those. And I also have a newsletter. If you haven't signed up, zerototravel.com/newsletter, where you can get a free weekly newsletter giving you some helpful links, some musings, and all that good stuff. So sign up over there for free. Okay. I'll leave you with this quote from Dr. Wayne Dyer, who said, if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Nice play on words there. Okay, I'll leave you with that. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you next week. Peace and love to you and yours. Cheers. Thanks again.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.